This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.
U.S. President Donald Trump has announced a 25% tariff on goods from countries which are doing business with Iran as a crackdown on protests inside Iran continues. The protests are entering their third week with at least 648 protesters killed. That's according to the human rights group Iran Human Rights, although other groups put the figure much higher than that. An internet blackout has been in effect in the country since last Thursday. So we want to know what exactly sparked the protests and is it possible that the regime in Iran itself is under threat? Vincent Jurek is Associate Professor at the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD and is with me now in studio. Vincent, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's talk about what was the spark for this particular round of protests, because there have been protests over the last couple of years.
There certainly have. Iran is no stranger to protests and mass mobilization. The immediate spark of the events of the last few days, and it's stretching on now, was a strike by merchants in the Grand Bazaar in Tehran. And that, in turn, was driven by a very significant increase in cost of living, essentially.
But the merchants themselves, the people who were trying to sell things, what were they saying? We can't sell at a price that people can afford?
Yeah, the paradox was that they were selling goods that were vastly more expensive, but that in effect meant that their market for those goods was disappearing. So they weren't making a living themselves because of the extent to which ordinary Iranians were impoverished, arising out of a huge spike in consumer prices over the course of just a few days, and that in turn feeding into a much greater cost of living crisis and economic crisis that has characterized the country for years.
Now, what prompted that quick spike in consumer prices?
There was a massive devaluation of the Iranian currency, the rial, which went from, I think, something like 700,000 to the dollar just a few months previously to 1,400,000 in mid-December.
So it halved the value, basically.
You could contrast that to something like 55,000 to the dollar when Pezeshkian, the new president, took office. So you're talking about an astronomical level of...
So these merchants are buying stuff on the real market where they have to pay real money rather than rails. They have to pay dollars or other hard currencies to get the stuff.
Absolutely. And they're increasingly looking at a situation where they're finding it difficult to survive. And certainly their customer base, if you like, is also like ordinary Iranians or have been struggling for the longest time. And this just pushed people beyond the point where they could tolerate it anymore.
So you had a strike by the merchants that brought people out onto the street. I mean, the regime was not going to slay the merchants because they need the merchants to keep everything turning over. So instead, they turned their gunfire on the protesters.
Yeah, I think what happened was surprising to just about everybody. I mean, in a sense, you can look at situations like Iran going back years and see how the depth of the economic crisis sooner or later is going to force people to do something, is going to challenge the regime. But the specific timing is always surprising. And what you got was that initial quite organized, industrial action, if you like, by merchants, which then prompted ordinary Iranians out onto the streets. And it spread, if you'll excuse the cliche, like wildfire. To begin with, you're talking about relatively small numbers. And within a few days, every single province in Iran was affected. Dozens and dozens and dozens of cities were affected. And very quickly you get the internet blackout so that we no longer can say with certainty exactly
what's going
happening.
On. But presumably the news gathering organisations, run by the state, I presume, in the main, they were reporting this initially.
They were reporting it initially, and what you get in the first couple of days is a sort of mixed set of messages from the regime, both from the supreme leader and the elected president, who has basically no power. It's almost a symbolic office, but nonetheless he operates as a channel for all sorts of perspectives. And that sort of twin message was, on the one hand, protest is legitimate. We know people are suffering. They can't deny it. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But rioting is un-Islamic. And that distinction allows them then to turn their guns against what they see as rioters who were fomenting chaos and, you know, attempting to orchestrate the downfall of the regime.
Now, I mentioned there have been protests before, and in a sense, the regime did respond to some of those protests last year by easing the ban on women, for example, having to cover their hair.
And it's not impossible that you'll see some sort of signalling in that direction, you know, in the coming weeks. I don't think it'll happen immediately. The difficulty for the regime is that it has limited options in terms of addressing the roots of the challenge that it's facing at the moment. And one option that it does have, of course, is in the social sphere, because while it might cost in terms of legitimacy from the point of view of hardliners in the regime and its hardline base, it doesn't cost in real terms. And if anything, it sort of assuages at least some of the discontent.
So there is the appearance of some liberalisation, which doesn't cost money.
There's the appearance, and there's also some talk, and again, it's very difficult at the moment to know quite how much weight to attach to any of this. There's some talk that there might be more than the appearance, that there might be a willingness on the part of some within the regime, essentially to say enough is enough to Khamenei, the supreme leader, who's 87, and move. You know, there is reference to Saudi Arabia, which has gone from being, you know, what's seen as this hardline Wahhabi state to one in which, well, we all know, you know, the sort of facade liberalisation that's taking place, but nonetheless the regime stays in power.
At the same time, you can't kind of be too cynical about any modernisation that takes place, because I could think back to Charlie Haughey and his contraceptive legislation, where you had to get a prescription or you had to, for condoms, you know, and you had to be married
absolutely.
To get condoms. But it was the thin end of a wedge that eventually liberalised the whole thing. So any step in the right direction should be welcome.
Absolutely, no doubt about that. And, you know, there have been all sorts of indicators of that, you know, if your perspective, historical perspective, goes back far enough. I mean, the education of women in Iran, for instance, has transformed the country, not just socially, but politically.
Now, let's go back to the beginnings of its troubles. When the Shah was got rid of, and we had the famous Ayatollah moving from Paris to Tehran, and the transformation of the country into a theocracy, I suppose, how well was the country working at that point?
It was working well, I think, in some respects, but it was a highly repressive regime. It was, excuse me,
I mean, they were selling oil on the international market.
They were selling oil in the international
so they had
market.
An income.
The 1960s was seen as a period of rapid economic transformation in Iran through to the 70s. There were, for instance, people have forgotten about this, there was an enormous land redistribution program of a kind that was more typically associated with socialist states in the Middle East. Iran, the Shah, enjoyed friendly relations with the United States, but also with Russia. It, in many respects, in fact, it seemed like an invulnerable regime. It's also worth, you know, bearing in mind that the revolution in 1979 wasn't, on the face of it, an Islamic revolution. It was a revolution that was essentially hijacked by an Islamic sector, but it was much more broadly based than that.
Now, you say the economy was working, and until, I suppose, Iran started to move in international directions in a way that the West perceived to be hostile.
Well, in many respects, the regime was seen as hostile from the beginning. So almost immediately, you have the invasion of Iran, which was in a very chaotic state in the first year of the revolution by Iraq. And what you see then is external powers very happy to see two regimes, neither of which they liked, fight it out, which is why you get this extraordinarily costly
war. People may have forgotten about that Iran-Iraq war because of the two invasions
indeed,
by America.
Indeed, and, you know, obviously from a Western perspective, you have, you know, Gulf War I and Gulf War II, but from a Middle Eastern perspective, you have three. Yeah. But this is the one that didn't really involve Western powers or indeed the Soviet Union or Russia. It came at enormous cost, you know, a million lives, disastrous impacts on the economy of both states, long-lasting effects geopolitically. But what it did do was set the tone for revolutionary Iran's approach to the rest of the world. You know, the notion of a great Satan, the notion of the unreliability of allies in the region. And then you get this move towards what they call forward defense, which is, you know, essentially not attack as the best form of defense, but, you know, creating allies in the region on which the regime could depend, which then destabilized the regime further. And then, of course, you get the catastrophic US-led invasion of Iraq, which upended the geopolitical balance and left Iran in a paradoxically strong position, which aroused all sorts of suspicions on the part of the major Sunni states, particularly in the Gulf.
And then there was a concern, of course, that given that Israel, which has never confirmed it, but is a nuclear power, it would appear, has nuclear weaponry at its disposal, and then the suspicion that Iran was developing nuclear weapons. I mean, it had the equipment, if not the raw materials, to go that far, and no proof has ever been shown, as with Saddam, weapons of mass destruction, that the Iranians were anywhere near developing a nuclear weapon. But the talks, which were confirmed by Obama, and progress had been made, and then Trump comes in and upends everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that again is a remarkable and important sort of critical juncture. As for nuclear weapons rather than a civilian nuclear program, there's this contested, I suppose, debate around a fatwa issued by Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, in which he declared that nuclear weapons were haram, they were un-Islamic, they should not be pursued. Others argue that the approach can be refined instrumentally in all sorts of ways. But certainly, as you say, there's no evidence that Iran has ever developed nuclear weapons. And then you have the negotiations and the joint comprehensive agreement that Obama and others put together in 2015, which was abrogated unilaterally by Trump almost immediately got into office.
That was almost guaranteed to bring stability had it held to the region, but...
And it did for a time. It brought stability of a sort, at least, and it brought some relief from sanctions. It strengthened the hands of those in Iran who wanted to continue negotiating with the West and, move incrementally towards ever greater relief and obviously an improvement in the economic conditions of the country. Didn't happen.
So those sanctions, which were beginning to be removed, allowing Iran to trade with the rest of the world, then reimposed following the Trump abrogation of that treaty, that gave rise, I suppose, to the poverty of Iran in terms of trying to just run itself. But allied with that, you say there was great mismanagement of even what they had.
Yeah, Iran is ranked, I can't remember the exact figure, but something like 157 out of 180 countries in terms of levels of corruption by Transparency International. So you have a very distorted economy in all sorts of ways. You have huge stake in the economy on the part of, for instance, the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which, like so many military or paramilitary actors in the Middle East, now has a very substantial share of the national economy, not simply its own sort of funding.
And this would be paralleled in Venezuela, for example, by the troops there and the military there who
absolutely
are invested deeply in the survival of what Chavez and Maduro constructed.
Absolutely. And it's the curse of oil. It's the curse of having those vast resources, which seems to condemn so many countries to instability and paradoxically to poverty. So you have rampant corruption and you have increasing awareness of it, because in this sort of curious hybrid system that Iran has, there's a parliament that can carry out investigations and reports, and there has been quite public reporting on some of this, which would be surprising, of a kind, for instance, that you wouldn't see in Egypt, where again the military has a huge economic stake in the economy.
Now the crisis, I couldn't believe to hear that Tehran, for example, almost ran out of water, a city of its size.
Yes, and water shortages are also at the heart of the distress that people are feeling right across the country. There has been for years now, there have been water shortages. So you're talking about a country with a shortage of water and with huge increases in previously subsidized petrol or gasoline. Some of the basics of a modern existence, and they're under threat.
The question is, can it hold? Or is there going to be regime change, whether or not Trump decides to punish the Iranians for their repression of those protesters or otherwise? I mean, can the regime hang on in there?
I think the regime can hang on in there for the medium term, but it can't hang on in there forever.
I'm thinking that relying on
repression.
If you come to a point where the policemen on the street refuse to shoot on their own people, as happened in Romania, for example, with the Ceausescus, and it's happened in other places where the people you're depending on to keep law and order say, no, we're not doing it.
This is a critical point. And, you know, you see it not just in Romania, you see it more recently in North Africa in the course of the uprisings in 2011. It was when the Tunisian army effectively refused to fire on the people who were protesting that it was clear that the game was up for Bin Ali in that country. So the big question in Iran is how the security services respond, how the military respond, but also how the IRGC respond. And this is the difference. You've got this body with, you know, more than 100,000 members, which was established solely to support the regime and which answers only to the supreme leader and is separate from the conventional military of the country and separate from the police force.
And we're depending on this for their wealth.
We're depending on the status quo, remaining the status quo for their power and wealth.
I mean, what happens if it looks like it's an inevitable, the Republican Guard Corps will vanish into the forest, as it were.
That's
if it's going to go badly for them, they will just evaporate.
And that typically is what happens. And that also calls into question the viability of military intervention on the part of Trump. I mean, quite what he's trying to target, quite what he would be trying to do, remains extremely vague at the moment.
I mean, he talked about the weapons he has at his disposal, which inevitably would kill ordinary people.
Well, you know, when you think that the protests are taking place in cities with, you know, very substantial populations, 12 million, probably more people in Tehran alone, how you target the security forces in a situation like that without doing damage elsewhere, and damage to the very people you're supposed to be trying to help.
What appetite is there for what kind of regime, if there is to be regime change?
That's a great question. And what seems to be the case at the moment is that you have a massive mobilization, popular mobilization across Iran, but very little by way of a coherent organization or coherent ideology, a coherent set of ambitions, which is why you get reference to, you know, the
Shah.
Son of the Shah. You know, this figurehead individual who has really very little by way of substantial support or traction in Iran.
And he himself doesn't want to have the resurrection of the monarchy himself. He says that.
So he says. He says that he favours a referendum, which Iran had in the past in 1980 on whether or not it should become an Islamic republic. But it's difficult right now to take anything, any of the talk associated with Reza Pahlavi too seriously. It seems not to be much more than kite flying on his part. And the real leadership, if there is going to be an alternative leadership, will come from within Iran, as it always does in situations like this.
From within the jails, maybe.
From within the jails, quite possibly.
Vincent, thank you very much for a fascinating insight into Iran and what's going on there. Vincent Jurek is Associate Professor at the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.